Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear our producer and editor, Taj Easton, because he is guest hosting today's episode. Take it away, Taj.
Thank you so much, Kevin. It's an honor as always. Hello, y'all. This is Taj. On this week's episode of Risk, you will also hear Luis Garcia.
Tuan seemed generally concerned. You know, he came over and he asked me what happened. I was like, my dog died, you know, bit a toad and fell in the pool and drowned. At this point, Tuan's face like bunches up and he looks at me and he's like, the fuck kind of friends you got?
That and more. But first, life is amazing. Life is wild and out of this world and weird and beautiful and strange. If you're feeling that and you have anything to tell, why don't you tell us about it? Send us stories about life and all its wild inanity and the strangeness of it all and how bizarre it is. Tell us something that's happened to you that was weird or beautiful or stupid or painful or interesting or curious or thought-provoking or just plain sexy. Send us your pitches, risk-show.com/submissions.
We'll be right back.
Now, here's the show. Hello, y'all. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Taj Easton, and this is Luke Vibert in the background now. And we're calling this week's episode Non-Consensual, as we have stories today about people crossing the line in sexual situations. Now, I'm expecting you won't find these stories quite as dark as you might be thinking with a title like that. I mean, this is serious stuff, to be sure. But there are also moments of levity in here, and I wouldn't call anything that happens in today's stories sexual violence. In any case, if that does not sound like something you want to hear about today, please take care of yourself, and we'll catch you on the next one. But if you are sticking around, I expect you'll find today's stories thought-provoking, or conversation-starting, or in some number of ways worth your while. In a little bit, we're going to hear from Rosalie Chandler. But before that, a story from Luis Garcia. Luis and I have become friends over the last couple of months. I freaking love this guy. He's a novelist. He is a storyteller. He is a multi-talented, multifaceted, delightful, and fascinating individual. And he has had a wild life. And I'm really looking forward to bringing you more stories from Luis in the future. In this story, in addition to the non-consensual sexual activity, there is also discussion of suicidal ideation and the suicide attempt. Also drug use. Also all kinds of prison shenanigans. This story is amazing and dramatic, but if none of that sounds like your cup of tea, might want to sit this one out. Here's Luis now with the story we call Escape from Antoine.
I'd been a functioning heroin addict since I was 19, and I had a sort of cycle going on. I'd get arrested, do a couple weeks in the county jail where I'd withdraw from heroin, and then get released to a rehab where I usually got kicked out for breaking one or both of the two cardinal rules you're not supposed to break at rehabs, not getting high or having sex. But anyway, Like any good, hardworking junkie, I was also a thief. But don't get me wrong, I wasn't a complete degenerate. I held jobs, I went to school, I sold weed, but heroin can get expensive. So, yeah. In 2001, I was arrested on campus by campus police for stealing digital scales from the chemistry department, among other things. That night, I caught a slew of charges, including burglary, grand theft, possession of all kinds, and escape when I somehow managed to escape from the fucking police car. I was so high that I couldn't even keep my eyes open for the fucking mugshot. Getting booked is erased from my memory, and when I wake up, I discover that I'm on the 7th floor of the Dade County Jail. There I am, like, I'm on the floor, on a mattress, you know, and I'm reading my AA form, which, yeah, I'm trying to piece together what happened. I'm still a little bit high, or maybe, like, hungover from all the Xanax I ate before the arrest, and I'm sitting there reading my AA form, like, trying to piece together what happened. One good thing about getting arrested is that you will always be issued an AA form, an arrest affidavit detailing your arrest. So I was sitting there reading that thing. It was in my pocket, and it didn't look good. Like, there was all these charges, like 6 pages, and it was all these charges, and the escape, everything is in there. I had a bond, but due to the escape charge, it had been revoked. And I'm just sitting there, and, like, all I could think through is I need another hit. But I knew I wasn't getting one. I'm not sick yet, but I'm in that junkie limbo state where, you know, I'm gonna get sick. So along one wall, there's like cells that can be open, but due to the overcrowded part, they're left open. And then a few steps one way is the bathroom and the shower that's totally exposed, which you always dread using, but you have to use. And then a few steps the other way is the benches and like a table and the TV, everything bolted down. And then the other wall has these windows that the officers look through for safety, but there never are any officers there. And then you got the 4 mattresses on the floor. And they're just like 6 inches apart. There's not much space for anybody. The guy who slept right next to me, his name was Antoine. He told me to call him Twan. He was basically the only guy out of the 20 guys in the cell talking to me. And he seemed nice enough, you know, well-read, bright, early 20s, had a thin mustache, had a do-rag. He was comfortable. He had been serving a life sentence in prison for a crime he said he didn't commit when he was 16. So a few hours after I woke up, that's when the withdrawals really started. First thing is like runny nose, uncontrollable yawning, and then like this desperation kicks in. I couldn't eat, so I was like giving all my trays to Twan. By evening, I couldn't hold water down. I'm vomiting every few minutes, and every time I'm sitting on the toilet, I don't even know what's coming out of my ass. Like, I'm shitting in front of the whole cell, okay, mind you. Meanwhile, I'm talking to my family on the phone about my case and what's gonna happen. And, you know, we're not talking about the elephant in the room, you know, like there's no point in shaming me. Everybody knew that I was a complete junkie and now I'm at the bottom, I'm in jail, you know. And due to the escape charge, I'm pretty much resigned to kicking my habit in there, which can take about a week, you know, physically. Psychologically, that's a whole other story. But then it gets worse. On the second day, I'm talking to my sister on the phone and she tells me that my dog died, Rocky, this little toy fox terrier I had. Basically my only friend at that point in my life. My girlfriend had broken up with me like 2 or 3 months prior, you know, so when I got off the phone, I was like crying. I was visibly distraught. And Twan seemed genuinely concerned, you know, he came over and he asked me what happened. I was like, my dog died, you know. It's like, oh man, I'm sorry, how'd he die? I'm like, I don't know, I bit a toad and fell in the pool and drowned. You know, my sister found him floating in the pool. At this point, Twan's face like bunches up and he looks at me and he's like, what the fuck kind of friends you got? So by dog, he thought I'd meant slang for friend. And we had a good laugh about this, trying to figure it out, you know, and I really needed that laugh at that moment, okay? But then on the third night, which is probably the worst night of the withdrawals, I actually fall asleep and I have a sex dream. And I think this happens a lot when you're dope sick because while your body is feeling just plain horrible, your subconscious mind wants to feel better. So you have either sex dreams or drug dreams. And I had a sex dream and I'll never forget this one. I'm like, I'm in a convertible with this chick and, you know, we're making out and she's giving me a hand job and like feeling her tits and it's like all hot and heavy. And just as I'm about to come, I wake up only to see Twan's hand just kind of, you know, finishing me off. Now, this is like the lowest point in my life until then. I get lower later in life, you know, but that's a whole other story. Right now, I'm dope sick. I don't feel well. I don't want to be touched. I'm not gay. Never have been when I was sober. And now I'm super sober, you know, but I just came. So I'm technically not angry, right? But I do feel a bit violated, right? So I fucking swat his hand off and I jump up off the mattress and like putting my boner away. I'm like, what the fuck, man? Now the whole cell is awake, everyone, right? And Twan fucking responds, what's up, man? He was liking that shit. He was making noises and shit. I just wanted a place to kick in peace, and this was not it. So I'm banging on the door, telling the cops that I'm in fear for my life. At this point, they're required to move me. I'm on the 7th floor. So floors 7 through 9 are your psych floors. Basically, anyone requiring medication. And as you go up from 7, the crazier it gets, with full glass-fronted observation cells and guys in paper jumpsuits and shit. So they shoot me up to the 8th floor, getting crazier now, mind you, where I miraculously get a bunk in one of the cells, but it's the 3rd bunk. You need a fucking ladder to get to it. They have a ladder welded to the sides of the bunks, and you climb up there, and then when you sit up on that fucking bunk, you're like 10 inches from the ceiling, where there's this buzzing fluorescent light that never shuts off. They don't turn the lights off in there. It's like part of the torture. And so I'm laying there trying to hide under this light, under this thin-ass sheet, and not only am I horrendously sick, but my life is over. No girlfriend, no dog. My college career and aspirations are over. I'm a disgrace to my family. I didn't last long up there. I keep peering over the side of the bunk, looking down, figuring where I'm going to throw myself, you know, and how to hold my arms together so that my head would hit the ground, like, directly. And it's just a non-decision. It's a fuck it moment where I just did it. I threw myself off and my head hit the ground. And then I kind of see the rest of my body coming down on top of me. And here come the fucking blankets too. Why was I still conscious? I couldn't even hurt myself, much less kill myself. So there I was, laying on the cold ass floor, pretending to be unconscious, hoping for blood to come pouring out where it felt like there was a nail in my skull. But blood never came, and they shot me down to the infirmary, which is on the 1st floor. This is a tiny, dark, depressing cell with a little square window in the door. Exactly what I needed. Because heroin withdrawals can be manic the first few days, you know. First day, you just want to get through the day without vomiting or shitting your pants. By the next day, you want to talk to someone in the morning. By midday, you want to be alone. By 6 at night, you're dreading the night because you know you won't sleep, and dying feels like a better option. But in this cell is where the desperation sort of lifted. I started to reflect on my situation and was able to reflect a little bit and think, and I was able to eat, you know. The self-inflicted psychic pain was still there, but I'd medicate that soon enough. I was let out 15 minutes to take a shower, shitty meals with like stale bread were the highlights of each day. And one day, I was only there 2 days. One day they brought me a phone. They had to bring an extension cord and stick it in through the slot. And I was talking to my sister on the phone and things were looking better in my case. And now I had a new goal. I'd get out of jail to be released to a rehab. Like the last 5 times, I fucking needed one. A few days passed before they figured out there was nothing physically wrong with me, and they shot me up to the 9th floor. Top tier crazy now. But I didn't land in one of the naked cells or observation cells. I graduated to that just a few months later. This time, I was in a regular 2-man cell with a red Dade County jail jumper with another guy who, thank God, had a broken jaw. So he was wired shut, couldn't talk. In these cells, since you're never getting out of the cell ever, the meals are pushed around these tall carts by trustees, other inmates from other cells, you know? And I think it was like the 3rd meal. Twan's pushing around those trays. I see him coming around. I'm like, here he comes. So he gets to my cell, he sees me, and I let the broken jaw guy get his liquid meal. And then it's my turn. I walk up to the slot, you know, and Twan hands me another tray, one on top of the other, and winks and blows me a kiss through the glass. Never had I been so glad to be locked in a cell with another man I didn't know, trust, or even remotely like. A few days passed and I got out. I wouldn't even make it to rehab that time. It's a whole other story, but I would end up in jail for a year where I would find the will to live again on the floor of a naked cell of all places. But I wasn't done. I'd get out a year later. And I'd get arrested 10 or so more times after that, with a few more rehabs and ODs thrown in. I'm not even kidding. I was a tough case. I didn't get clean until 9 years later, 2 years into a 10-year prison sentence for trafficking LSD, which is a whole other fucking story. Today, I have a wife and a toddler and a house and a car and bills and what people call problems and shit. But like I keep saying, it's a whole other story.
Hey, I'm Rhett.
And I'm Link.
Maybe you know us from our daily YouTube show, Good Mythical Morning.
But this is a little trailer for our podcast, Ear Biscuits, where two lifelong friends talk about life for a long time.
And nothing is off limits. We talk about our sex lives, our mental health journeys, but we try to never take ourselves too seriously.
So we invite you to not do the same, or to do the same. We invite you to listen. Follow and listen to Ear Biscuits.
Now for free on the Odyssey app and everywhere you get your podcasts.
We're back.
Peoria Jazz. Don't Dudlow Joe. I can break out of any old chair, you know. The bars are iron. The walls are stone. All I need, man, is a whole. Some fish in the jailhouse tonight. Some fish in the jailhouse tonight. Some fish in the jailhouse tonight. All right. Oh yeah. There's some fish in the jailhouse tonight. Oh boy. There's some fish in the jailhouse.
This is Risk. This is Tom Waits in the background now, and we just heard from Luis Garcia. These days, Luis is a commercial fisherman and charter boat captain running eco-historic tours of Biscayne Bay and the Upper Keys. You can also find Luis on Instagram at TheNiceCuban. Keep your ears peeled because I'm hoping to have Luis back on Risk again really soon. Friends, one of our Patreon patrons, Patrick Sheehan, recently sent us this note along with his donation while we are struggling to keep Risk running. I've been listening to Risk from the jump, and it is by far my favorite podcast. My Risk funny story is I've only ever listened to the podcast on a Bluetooth speaker twice. I was putting together some furniture after moving to a new apartment both times. Both times the episodes were about scat fetishes. Both times my brother-in-law, there to help us with the moving, walked in at the precise moment the storytellers were getting into the very fine details of their fetish. All I could do was shrug and say, "That's Risk." He's also a listener now. Thank you, Risk. Ha! Thank you so much, Patrick. Getting messages like this from our fans is just so incredibly uplifting. I'm telling y'all, it's scary where we're at right now, and it is such a huge boost to get these reminders that what we're doing matters to people. I am so, so grateful to our audience, seriously. And for our Patreon supporters, we have a new check-in from Kevin on the way. Kevin has been on a massive trance retreat for the past several weeks, and I, for one, am extremely eager to hear what he's been getting up to. And there's plenty more where that came from at patreon.com/risk. Next up, we got a story from Rosalie Chandler. Rosalie is a wonderfully talented writer, storyteller, lecturer. And in this particular tale, you're going to hear Rosalie getting really vulnerable with us. I don't know that I would call what happens in this story sexual assault, but there is a lack of consent going on here. So if that's going to be triggering for you, I'd skip this one. And now, without further ado, this is Rosalie Chandler with a story we call The Worst Thing I've Ever Done.
Something fish in the jailhouse tonight. asked you what the worst thing you ever did was, would you know the answer right away? This is the question I posed to my best friend Shannon over brunch last May. And she looked at me suspiciously over her mimosa and cautiously replied, yes. And then I asked her, would you ever tell anyone? And she immediately replied, oh, no, absolutely not. So the reason I was asking her this question is that I had been asked to be part of a storytelling show similar to this one. And through the workshopping and prompts, this story had come out, a story that I truly never meant to tell anyone. So obviously I was very nervous about sharing it for the show. So I was running it by Shannon first to see how it went down. So sweating over my brunch in a hip Brooklyn restaurant, I told Shannon my story. And my story is, when I was 16, the summer I was 16, I was hanging out with this guy, Jack. We were part of a big circle of friends, and then we found ourselves hanging out alone a couple times. I was maybe kind of a party girl, and he was a little more innocent. Our first date, if you could call it a date, was at a rave where I bought us acid and ecstasy. Candy flipping, yeah, candy flipping. So after that, he found a way to spend the night at my house. And so we're making out on my creaky futon bed. We are not on acid or ecstasy at this point. And he tasted like Carmex lip balm, which he always tasted like. And I think that every girl in our circle of friends had a crush on Jack. Once in this really rare moment of immodesty, Jack said, you know, I've been likened to Michelangelo's David. And I could see it. He had black, wavy hair, olive skin, tall, a little shy, very quiet. And so I am making out with Jack. And then we're poised to have sex. And knowing he's a virgin, I said, are you sure you want to do this? I had only had sex with one other person, but Jack said, yeah. And knowing the first time's a big deal, I said, are you sure? And he said, no. But I was in a position where I could proceed anyway. So we had sex. He seemed to enjoy it. Later that summer, he went away to a sleepaway camp, and I didn't see him or hear from him again until right before school started. He finally called me, and he said that he didn't want to hang out with me anymore. He said that he didn't want sex and drugs and whatever other bad things I had brought into his life anymore. At that point on the phone, he also said, and besides, you basically raped me. To which I said, what? And he said, I said no, and you had sex with me anyway. So I played it back from a couple months before, and I mean, yeah, that's what happened, but guys can't be raped. I mean, in 1999 or 2000, whenever this was, that was a more or less universally accepted truth. You know, guys have to be erect, they have to be into it, therefore a guy can't be raped. But at the same time, I mean, I had known taking his virginity was kind of a big deal, and now the fact that he said that he felt like he had been raped, I mean, that's horrible, and I had done that. That was the worst thing I'd ever done. Jack and I never really discussed it again. We were still in the same circle of friends at school, but he made it pretty clear that he was not happy with me. I don't remember the context of the conversation, but at one point talking with a group of friends, I said, oh, that was before I knew you, to Jack. And Jack said, those were the days. So I knew he did not like me, and I knew that I deserved it. Not that I had tried to apologize to him or anything, but it didn't seem like the type of thing you could apologize for. It was something that I was going to have to live with, that we were both going to have to live with for the rest of our lives. But then at the end of our junior year, Jack gave me this friendship bracelet that he had made. And it was on a postcard, and the postcard had this legend of what each of the threads meant. And there was yellow for friendship and red for passion, and there was definitely black for anger. And there was pink for forgiveness. But, I mean, I was really touched to get the bracelet, and things were better between us after that, but I didn't think it meant that I could actually be forgiven. I mean, no amount of pink thread is going to change the fact that I had raped someone. That's permanent. So, back at brunch, Shannon says, "Well, it sounds like he definitely forgave you." And I frowned and I ate some of my waffles before telling her about senior year. At the end of our senior year, we were all in the gymnasium to sign yearbooks. I can still feel the rubberized floor beneath my feet and smell adolescent sweat. Not my sweat. I cut gym as much as possible. But even though things had been good between us, I was really nervous when I handed my yearbook over to Jack to sign. I still fully expected him to write, "I hate you and you ruined my life." But then I looked at what he had actually written. I was still in the gym, sitting on the bleachers, and I peeked in the yearbook, and I slammed the yearbook closed with a gasp and a laugh and a cringe and a flood of embarrassment and confusion. Jack's message to me said, "Hey, remember that time we had sex? That was fun. You throw great parties. Love, Jack M." And I'm sitting in the gymnasium, like in the school, and he's writing in pen in my yearbook about the time we had sex, the time I had raped him. And then I told Shannon, actually, it hadn't just been that one time. There had actually been a period of time between the incident and when Jack went away to sleepaway camp that we had continued to hang out and we had had sex a couple more times at least. And I also reminded Shannon, "Remember when I went to Texas last year? That was with Jack. We're still friends." "Okay," said Shannon. "If he kept sleeping with you after the first time and you're still friends now, I don't think he felt like you had raped him the first time." And that was good logic. But what Shannon wasn't factoring in was the 2017 Me Too movement. So many people were coming out with their rape stories, and there was so much more enlightened conversation about, you know, men being raped. And, you know, if someone said they were raped, they had been raped. Believe women, believe men, believe anyone who said they'd been raped. So I felt worse and worse even later in the, you know, since this had happened. That brought up a whole new bunch of feelings that I then immediately shoved down and resolved to never admit this to anyone, not even myself, if possible. But then here I was telling it to Shannon over brunch, and she hadn't disowned me as a friend. I hadn't been struck by lightning and died on the spot. So I guess I was going forward with this storytelling show. But first, I had to tell Jack. So I texted Jack. I said, "Hey, I'm going to be part of this storytelling thing, and it's going to be recorded and podcast and online. And so I thought you should know because I'm going to be telling the story about the time that we had sex." Whew, panic attack, waiting for the text back. He responds immediately. He says, "Yeah, okay. I'd be interested to hear your perspective on that story." So I email him the draft of the story, which is ready to go, ready to be performed in a couple of days. And I hit send and I panic and wait and sweat for him to respond to me. And he writes back, "I remember everything happening exactly the way you said it, but I had no idea you were still feeling guilty about it. I definitely forgave you a long time ago. In fact, I don't even know why I said I felt like you had raped me. I didn't know you were still carrying this around." And I had been carrying it around for 23 years. So the last part of the text message exchange was when I finally felt like I could maybe really let this go. And I know this is not typical for a rape incident. I know it's a very serious topic and it can't expect to have it be forgiven and go away. But in this case, I was just a confused teenager. We both were. So maybe it was okay to forgive it. The last part of the text message, the last thing Jack said was, "The one no was far less significant than all of the exuberant yeses that followed." So maybe if you know what the worst thing you ever did was, maybe it's not as bad as you think. And maybe if you could just bring it out into the light, you could be forgiven. Or maybe I just got lucky. I don't know. But I do know that I'm going to try and focus on the exuberant yeses in my life instead of the noes. Thanks.
I'm back, my car.
This is Risk. This is Modest Mouse in the background now, and we just heard from Rosalie Chandler. I don't know about y'all, but I particularly enjoy the opportunity to reflect on these issues of consent and the lack of consent, and to have a platform where we can talk about stuff that is kind of hard to talk about, that it maybe feels shameful or deeply personal or vulnerable or controversial. And I think that we are so much better off when we can get these kind of subjects out in the open, off our chest, be seen, be heard, be understood, start conversations like this. So thank you so much to Lewis. Thank you so much to Rosalie. Thank you so much to Kevin for letting me host the episode this week. And thank you so much to you, the fans of Risk, who make all this possible. All right, y'all, that's all I got for you today. Thanks for being here. Thanks for bearing with me. And thank you for being the most wonderful audience I could ever conceive of. We got more episodes coming at you Thursday and Tuesday and some Wednesdays, and we are going to stay in your ears as long as it is physically possible for us. But that is the future, folks. And today is the day. Take a risk.
Worry, we'll all float on. We'll all float on.